and we're looking at my my charts I made years ago, and we're finishing up the it's called Bob's Formula Chart, which goes from 1750 to 2020, and we went through the different levels. We got down to the bottom. So, Cameron, I'm looking at the homeopathic cliche probes, which is the ALP ground on the left. And then following that is the anthropomorphic physical. I think we talked a bit about this, but not maybe we did. Did we do Perot? We did Perot and satellite and laser beam and all that stuff, right? We just didn't do
the... depending on what you mean by did. I'm not sure that we did a very thorough analysis of those lines. But we did briefly talk about all three of the horizontal lines at the bottom of that chart.
The three spaces, three levels at the bottom.
Yeah, the three levels.
Yeah. Do you remember what I said about the flat line in the bottom section, bottom level?
Actually, I think that was at the very end of our conversation, and you simply said that that was flat line like a heart monitor in the hospital.
Yeah.
And that the ground had flatlined.
Right. So you notice that I've got, as part of the actors acting out stresses and retrievals, I've got homeopathic cliche probes. Now, what the heck are they? And I did talk about them, explain them. But in my book, I say homeopathic cliche probes are memes. So you've got memes as the enemy, technological, cultural enemy. But the weaponry is satellite and laser beam. So the imagery that would go with that for satellite and laser beam, that would be Reagan's Star Wars, which came in 83 as a popular image. And it's up against a rapidly changing turnover of culture of memes. And, yeah, memes, as they are defined by Richard Dawkins. But the... it became a kind of, I don't want to say synthetic culture, but culture started to be what the global theater occupants or actors engaged. So there would be fads often coming out of America. But as the baby boomers traveled around the world in the 70s and 80s more, and people did through jets, other cultures became memes like world music. You know what I mean? You remember that?
I understand what you're saying, but I'm not entirely clear how you're using the word meme.
It's a pattern that everybody gets into. It's like the phrase, where it's at. McLuhan was talking about in the 60s that people were trying to find out where it's at, so he'd play off the term. The phrase, where it's at, which suddenly became popular, or another one was doing your thing. So those kind of phrases that became part of the language is actually... what politicians and everybody would use the latest cliches that had been created in the speed up and the increasing depth of consciousness. So the phrase that would come out of it would call a meme.
Mm-hmm.
And it organized people's sense of community in a very fragmented situation, but also a very imploded situation.
Right. But so a meme, in this sense, is a medium.
Yes. This is where the medium becomes content. He starts to talk about it in the Playboy interview, and then in Take Today on page 11, he talks about how man becomes both figure and ground. So man becomes not an extension of a medium, but a creator of the medium or part of the medium, and it would that would be resolved as a pattern or a cliche or a fad.
Yeah. So
now I show that in my tiny note chart, so I'll develop that when we bring that out.
Okay, good. To me, that's related to the flat line, because when humans become figure and ground, when humans become creators of creation, that attempt at stability falls through itself and is finally revealed as groundless.
As groundless? So did you say groundless?
Groundless, yeah.
Yeah, that's a... I remember talking about that with Barry Nevitt in the late 80s. We were in a groundless situation, which is probably what I meant by the flat line. But this led to incredible instability, personally, psychologically, sociologically, culture.
That's right.
And for many people, it was apocalyptic or Armageddon. It just shattered them, and they became zombies. They fell back into some older pattern that they thought would last longer. And that's the rise of fundamentalism all over the world, including in science. So everybody froze on the controls was my phrase back then. And that's the part of the meaning of the flat line. Nobody knew how to get out of that situation.
Correct. That's what I call the cul-de-sac.
Yep, I agree. Yep, a cul-de-sac.
To me, this is a good place to bring up media and the inflation crowd.
Good.
Which McLuhan wrote in 1973. And what I'd like to do just for the record is read a few passages from the very end of this essay, because I think it relates centrally to what we're talking about.
Yeah, I have a question about that. He did a couple of New York Times op-eds, and one was called McLuhan, 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 and one was What You Have, and then the other one was A Media Approach to Inflation. Does the one you have begin talking about Nixon?
No, but it ends talking about Nixon.
Yeah, do you know the one called McLuhan, McLuhan, McLuhan?
I've seen it. I probably have it somewhere, yeah.
Okay, because you might want to compare that in the media and the inflation crowd.
Right.
Okay, let's hear the quotes.
Okay, so he says, if ordinary technologies are extensions of the human body in the quest to create new service environments, Sputnik, October 4th, 1957, and its successors, may represent something quite different, namely an extension of the planet itself, creating a new ground for man in the sky and calling despotically for a new equilibrium and harmony of action and knowledge. So that's the first quote that I want to bring up. And I would relate that to the line in your chart that is the holopathic cliche probe line that I believe represents a flip from ALP as ground to HCE as ground.
Yes. Yeah, you're talking about the third last one.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So that the when human beings are no longer able to ground themselves in some particular form of identity that belongs to the earth, they're thrown into an environment where they need to make sense of the universe. They and come back from a sense of the universe to a sense of the planet, and then from a sense of the planet back to a sense of their culture and their identity.
Yes, and he talks about, I think in the 60s, that we were going to move into a new metaphysical revolution, a renewed interest in metaphysics, and he might have even mentioned in Greece at the time of the phonetic alphabet. But yes, the people reaching out for a metaphysical pattern is a stress created by the situation you just described.
That's right. And he actually continues the quotation I just made by something that relates very closely to this. He says, the satellites have, as it were, transformed the planet itself into a work of art, inspiring a new need for programs and controls transcending all regional interests. So the what's interesting here is that a few minutes ago you brought up the quest for fundamentalism, which is an attempt to find closure in the face of complexity.
Yeah.
But what McLuhan is saying here, he's saying that we need to have programs and controls transcending all regional interests. He doesn't mean regional only in terms of space. He means regional in terms of any particular interest at all. The programs
any
and
medium at all.
Sorry?
Any medium at all. Interest or
well,
medium.
No, I don't think that's the case. I think it's humans need to relate themselves to a medium that is somehow inclusive of all media.
Well, they make it the hologram image, you know, the little part contains the whole. People become extreme, and that led to the culture wars about particular media mixes that they value.
Yes, but I think that what you're saying there is true, but it's a very complicated action that you're talking about, because you're talking about people taking particular actions, which is one thing, and you're talking about the understanding of people taking those particular actions, which is another thing.
Yep. It's reactionary. People.
That's right. And seeing how those belong together is the trick.
Is a what? A trick?
Is the trick.
The trick, right. The like, take the Arabs. They are manuscript culture. And the electric identity crisis that came upon them, they began to see, say, television, movies, American culture as the threat. And that's what they went to war against. So it was one media mix against another. But in particular, it was a manuscript bias that they had against technologies, industrial electric technologies. And then you can see that in different cultures or different nations around the world. They favored something. Usually that became their tourist market. They would wake up their cultural bias, their cultural treasures, for people to gawk at as museum tourists. And McLuhan criticized the West's bias to thinking the world was a museum. And meanwhile, everybody was involved with pattern recognition in the virtual world of computer, satellite, and the economy. And you see a reference to that at the back of, on the outer sleeve of Take Today, where he talks about software in quotes and software not in quotes. I think that's a very interesting dialectic when you read the back page of the cover. So then these get the effect of Sputnik is gradually, as more and more satellites go up and more of the popular images gets into outer space, that is actually, as an effect, a hologram that people are living in, which I say is the word that makes the market. And that hologram, this satellite proscenium, shrinks, gets tinier and tinier, like homeopathy. And that's what a homeopathic situation is. The global theater becomes tinier and tinier as the, especially with the digital world, but it begins with cable TV and the technologies just before the internet and that. So you mentioned that homeopathic cliche probes comes out of the Sputnik environment. Yes, But it's the later merger and implosion of individuals and groups and media, because the media is gradually disappearing, and then it's all contained in your smartphone. The metaphysical conceptualization, which becomes ground of that, are memes. So that's what I'm trying to get at. And, of course, it becomes an Android automatic meme. And so people become not zombies, but they become a kind of uniformity of shared awareness all around the world, like at airports and that, that alienates those that value, remember, identify with older technologies. I always think of what Norm Mailer said. You know, he traveled around the world a lot as a famous author, and he said it was damn boring. Every nation around the world had the same airport. And, of course, the popular disgust with McDonald's taking over anywhere, all everywhere, that was, you could say, an eye bias about incredible variety that was happening in the airports and in hotels. In depth through whatever entertainment was featured over the speakers, the Muzak. So most people got alienated by the computerized digital tactility that was taking over, that everybody's engaged in. So you know, someone like Frank Zappa would travel all over the world and he would study different discos. But discos were everywhere. So that was a new culture. It wasn't electric. It wasn't American imperialism. It was everybody having access to new media at the same time. Am I, what did McClune used to say? Am I getting through to you?
Yes, definitely. Just to skip ahead briefly through a mention, and then we'll come right back to where you are. But this kind of perception is what, in your book, you direct at Trump.
Yes.
Right? You differentiate between what everybody sees and what disgusts everybody, like you were just talking about with Muzak and McDonald's, and what could be seen with a different vision.
That's right.
And so that, I think, relates very much to this essay. So what I'd like to do here is just give you a few more quotes from the end of it, because I think it'll be helpful to us.
Right. Now, the phrase, because, the inflation crowd, that's the turnover of memes in the global theater, then the global membrane, and then turnover holopathic cliche probes. That's, to me, the crowd mentation or pattern recognition. And he talks by 74 about the problem, the addiction to the cognitive thrills of pattern recognition. That's the inflation crowd for me, not just money, but of fads and memes. It's inflated.
Right. But I think the heart of what he's talking about is a structural point, right? That as the individual finds herself more and more taken over by the environment of noise, you could say, the relationship between the individual and the environment becomes increasingly disparate, and the increasing tension between individuality and universality is what generates the turn to the crowd, which is to say the abdication of individuality, which can no longer be maintained.
Yeah.
And that gets directly to what I want to read here. He says that creating a new ground for man. We were just talking about how the new ground is in the sky, right?
And yes.
That's alike saying the new individuality is in the crowd, right? It's crazy.
Yeah.
So he says here, universal information services represents a desperate depreciation of our most exciting values. And by exciting, he doesn't mean something that we find greatly pleasurable or something like that. He means values that ground us and that give us something to go out from. So
yep.
Desperate depreciation of our most exciting values with the accompanying decline of personal identity and worth. Right? So we have what goes with the sky environment as ground is that the although this seems to be inflation, in one sense, it's actually also deflation to the same extent.
Yes, and stagflation.
Yes, well, stagflation is the combination of the two.
Yeah. And he talks about, in an article in 1970, about he predicts in the 70s a Great Depression. Now, he meant economically, but also psychologically, the two things you're talking about. Collectively
yeah.
And personally, and they come together, and no therapy can deal with this. He had
correct.
The best quote therapy for understanding this. If you, as everybody did, found themselves in the cul-de-sac.
Yeah, and his second sight there was seeing 2021.
Yes, yeah.
That's where we're at.
At the flat line.
Right there. Well, yeah, but in the new kind of depression, economic and psychological, that's coming down the pipe.
Yeah, yeah. Let me see. Did you know that line, Mediacology or something? It's in Take Today, and he says, the future of ecology lies not on a national or international basis, but in the realm of psychic ecology.
Right.
Remember that line?
Yes.
That's really important.
That's basically what we're talking about.
Yes.
Right. When we talk about transcending all regional interests.
Yes.
That's getting away from national and international interests.
Yeah, we see the conflict between the nationalists and the globalists. That's the eye ear, or maybe later terms. But that's what we're looking at in 2021. And they're both forlorn figures, like in my chart. One is
correct.
The enemy, and one's the weaponry.
Yeah. The in fact, both the national and the international attempt to retain their ground in the earth when what has happened is that the ground of the earth has been flipped into the ground of the sky, and the two which seem to be at war with each other are actually brothers who are attempting to find ground where there is no ground.
Right, and that's the phrase tuning the sky.
Yeah.
That he used. So, see, I thought when on the radio, I said McLuhan has come up with the terms for balance, for therapy, for whatever people think they're missing, whatever you would call something that fills in that lack. And I still think so. And Corinne says it in one of those documentaries, interviews, maybe a CD, a 90 CD she's interviewed. And she said, Marshall's correct intellectually. He has come up with the best statement that's simple enough that anybody could get it if they were patient enough. And then she balks and she said, well, but I don't know if it's practical. But she knew he had come up with a great, the old Shelley thing, poets are legislators of the world. Well, he completed that. He, as a poet, he came up with a legislating meme or process of looking at the situation, a psychic ecology. And that's what's missed. People get read McLuhan and get enthusiastic, but they have to do a little more study to realize how to see what we're talking about right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely, definitely. And the reason for that is what I'm just going to read now. This is the very end of the essay, and he's talked about how we need something beyond regional interest, and then he said that that results in a desperate depreciation. And the depreciation comes from the fact that humans always had their ground on the earth in a certain sense. It came from their language. It came from their culture. It came from a sense of themselves that they got from their mother, whatever. And now this was being taken away.
Yep.
Resulting in depreciation. So at the end of the essay, he says, so extensive a dissolution of established forms brings a universal feeling of outrage that calls for massive retaliation. The matter is stated memorially by Elias Canetti in his discussion of inflation and the crowd. So what we have here is a quotation from Canetti. And what he says is, no one ever forgets a sudden depreciation of himself, for it is too painful. Unless he can thrust it onto someone else, he carries it with him for the rest of his life. And the crowd as such never forgets its depreciation. But remember, when we're talking about the crowd, we're talking about the divorce between the individual and the crowd, and the inability of the individual to hold out against the crowd. And so when Canetti says the crowd as such never forgets its depreciation, and that's because what the crowd is as such is that depreciation of individuality, right? It's,
yep.
The crowd is the destruction of the individual, you could say.
Right. Now, but remember, there's also the destruction of the tribal crowd, too, in the other cultures.
The crowd, when the crowd overtakes the individual, that's not a stable ground. That's a ground that explodes and implodes. Nothing is more explosive and implosive than a figure that has taken over its ground, or a ground that has taken over its figure. And so when the tension between the individual and the crowd can no longer be maintained and flips over into only the crowd, that's not a stable situation. That's the most
volatile,
unstable situation. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's the flat line, you could say.
Yes. Now, what's interesting is when you've read a lot of McLuhan's articles like we have, he repeats his themes, media are extensions of our bodies. But I found that every article, uncannily, would add a few new words. And the words you're saying there, the depreciation of values, exciting values, different terms, he never said them in any previous article. But he adds a little aspect of what's going on in normal terms, not jargon, not media jargon, which helps you understand that, oh, he's not seeing this as a great thing or a bad thing or a dangerous thing. It's balance. And he shows common words. And he would do that. Like, if you take that article from 73, then look at McLuhan, I think it is, on Watergate in 74, and then a media approach to inflation, he adds a few more little words. And if another aspect of maybe practical institutional problems. Like, often,
right.
People, when they first read him, it was too abstract. He just seemed to be talking, about vast spaces and vast stretches of time, and how do you apply it? Well, it's almost like he would scan through his articles when he had a new one to read, say, okay, I did that, he'd check that off, and I did psychology, I did sociology, okay, now the next one is maybe the art world. And so he would add a little interesting new twist to it, and that's why his articles were a story. If you knew that it'd be the same old themes every article, but then he'd add a new twist. And what you just read, he never writes those sentences again.
Yeah.
With those words.
I would use a slightly different image. You're talking about him going through the articles and checking off what he's done. I don't think that he thought that way. I think he was like an artist who had his studio, and he would get up every day and he would have to decide, am I going to make a new picture today? If I am, what's its theme and all that sort of stuff? Or am I going to add maybe a few strokes to this painting that I did the other day or this painting that I did last year?
Yes.
And these new words and new phrases that you're talking about are kind of new strokes. They're things that he probably wasn't quite sure himself that they would work. He would know that he would have to come back into the studio in the next week or the next month. And he knew what it was like to regret having spoiled a picture by adding stuff to it, or regret having done a picture at all, maybe, and having to throw it out. But in this process, he was not entirely conscious of everything that was going on, but he had a sense of, what color seems to be missing here. How could I put a little stroke here? And by doing that, he was revealing through his sense of what do I do today. He was revealing a whole new sense of the human psyche.
That's right. And how to live today, how we live constant pattern recognition. And,
yes, sir.
And your personal myth, which would be the media you engage as a routine. What you've just spelled out is what I meant, but you did it a lot more precisely or colorfully using the artist metaphor. Yeah, like... I would think, no, he didn't even sit there and review, check his articles. He might, but he knew his work so well, he knew what he had done. And then he would get a new idea or say, okay, I haven't done that part yet. I haven't talked about social services or something. And so he would do it in the next article. He kind of knew his work so well, he would think up the next color to add naturally. It would just come to him.
Yeah. And what he would do is, for example, in media and the inflation crowd, there are paragraphs of this essay that appear elsewhere.
Yes.
And almost all of his essays, there are chunks of other stuff.
Yeah.
And so what McLuhan would do is he would take a chunk here and a chunk there, and he would kind of interface them and wonder if he had skipped something or if it didn't make sense when they were brought together. And in this sense, it's almost like a sculptor using his tactile sense to try to figure out if the shape that he had before him, partially from maybe past attempts at shaping it, if this made sense now. And so he would make a little gouge here and round out something there and sort of feel his way forward. And what we find from him is a model of what it is to think.
Yes. Integrated thinking, not in the literate left hemisphere synthesis, but somehow alive with the support of second sight and invigorated with what was going on. He, as he said once or twice in the Monday night seminars, this French critic came over and he was talking about the meaninglessness everywhere. And Marx said, oh, no, not for me. I find meaning everywhere.
Yeah.
And he would demonstrate it. He would, anything that happened, like streaking, which happened in 73, 74, he had a great pattern about it immediately.
Yeah, yeah, the passing fancy.
Yeah. Or the other part was, the streaker was telling us that, why are we getting all dressed up with nowhere to go?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, there's a good bunch of articles in 73, 74 that he did in newspapers and that.
Well, yeah, he was constantly alive. But let me just finish this. I'm almost at the end of this essay, so I'd like
I want to add about Kennedy.
I'm in the middle of the Kennedy quote.
Yeah.
Right.
But wait a minute. I want to point out that Kennedy, he would quote a lot in that period, but especially he had a great insight about why the Jews suffered in Germany in the 30s. They became the scapegoat of the Germans who were losing their identity the way you've been describing. And he had a great section where Kennedy pointed that out.
Yeah. So that's actually very important to what I'm about to read.
Okay.
Because he says, the crowd as such never forgets its depreciation. Right? And remember that I think, I don't know about Kennedy, but I think McLuhan is thinking of the crowd here in terms of the breakage of the tension between the individual and the collective or the universal.
Yeah.
So Kennedy goes on as follows. The crowd as such never forgets its depreciation. The natural tendency afterwards is to find something which is worth even less than itself, which one can despise as one was despised. It is not enough to take over an old contempt and maintain it at the same level. What is wanted is a dynamic process of humiliation. Something must be treated in such a way that it becomes worth less and less, as the unit of money did during the inflation. And this process must be continued until its object is reduced to a state of utter worthlessness. So that relates exactly to what you were just saying about the Jews.
Yeah.
The last line of this essay, which is what McLuhan adds to the Kennedy quote, is as follows. The Watergate affair is precisely such a dynamic process of humiliation.
Exactly.
Okay? Now, so we have to think of this. I'll just briefly mention the fact that what's going on with Trump recapitulates the Watergate affair in the way that is being talked about here. But we'll get to that when we discuss your book.
Yes.
What I want to bring up here is that McLuhan takes up from Kennedy the idea of humiliation and how it's necessary to humiliate the other as a way of getting a sense of oneself. Now, humiliate comes from humus, earth, right?
Yeah.
And we've just talked about how humans are in the satellite environment are directed to the sky, away from the earth.
Yes.
Right? And that's like what you have in the homeopathic cliche probe line of your chart. You have this kind of flip between ALP and HCE, so that instead of people finding ground in ground, they find it in the air, in the figures of the air, you could say.
Yes.
And so here in this essay, McLuhan very nicely says that so we have to find our new ground in the sky, and it has to be beyond all regional interest. And once we are thrown into that environment where we're depreciated, the natural tendency is to seek humiliation. That is to say, to go back to the earth, right?
Yes.
And the way to go back to the earth is to find something that is worthless that in depreciating it into its farthest reaches of worthlessness, we make contact again with our ground in earth, right? And of course, all that's ridiculous, but that's the history we're living.
Yes, and that one of the first memes to come out of the post-war era is ecology and trying to, you know, archetypalizing the ground, the earth.
Yeah, correct.
Which was actually the wrong direction to go in McLuhan's terms. It wasn't,
that's right.
Well, didn't provide understanding.
Yeah, ecology and pollution only became illuminated, you could say, from a satellite perspective.
Yeah, once we were up in the air.
Yeah, yeah. So what people were doing and are doing in their concern for ecology and pollution, all that sort of stuff, is that they're it's a variety of what you call a lockdown rule, where people are attempting to find meaning through organization, but they are, as you just said, looking in the wrong direction.
Yeah. So a trend to prove the flip from male to female, male becoming the retrieved ground or the ground role taken over by men or the male, is you see by the late 70s, early 80s, and I heard a lot about this in Carolyn's practice. You know, she had a lot of baby boomer patients. They all were getting burned out, and they thought their women's lib or whatever feminist doctrines they had would take over with their reasonableness or rationality. It's obvious women should be allowed to participate more. But there was a larger post-human discarnate condition in the sky that was wearing everybody down, but especially women. And so women gave up in the 80s. The feminist myth or meme died, and women became, well, yuppie males, yuppie executives, all kinds of strange things, which didn't work either. So we saw that in the erosion of the feminist movement. It was called the second wave, and it didn't make it to the 90s. Now, today, Me Too, that's a lot of humiliation and resentment in that. And so these terms that you're pointing out by McLuhan, you see in Croker, you see in the postmodernists, usually Croker is an inventory of all the different postmodernist architects. And so you have resentment, disgust, and a bunch of other terms that Croker sees everywhere, and that is in the 80s and 90s. But McLuhan got there first, describing it in simple terms, like eroding of values. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The
sure. I wouldn't call that first, though. I mean, an awful lot of the stuff Nietzsche was talking about in the 1880s.
Yeah, but he saw the technical ground. That's the problem with a lot of postmodernists. They didn't study McLuhan enough. They thought they were discovering ground. A pattern that was new, but it had been done in a more basic, practical way by McLuhan already. I did an essay. I went through all the major postmodernists and took all their themes from all their books, their main themes, and showed by chapter and verse where McLuhan said it before them.
And you can you just need to look at history to know that none of those supposed answers work.
Right, and McLuhan understood that himself. He says back in 53, as he's laying out, I think it's in Culture Without Literacy, the first issue of Explorations, he says, we're going to present this program, but it's going to include a lot of self-correction.
Right.
See, whoever presented a program and allowed it to be a two-way corrective process, a dialogue. Everything in the Gutenberg Galaxy was the one-way song, to quote Wyndham Lewis. You had the solution, mm-hmm. and you imposed it on everybody. You know, whereas the McLuhan was saying, no, we don't have a final literate declarative statement, but we do have a process that requires a cul-de-sac comprehensive understanding of how it'll unravel you and also inspire you.
Right.
Is there anybody, maybe art movements did that, but it was around art objects. You know, they mm-hmm. take the Pre-Raphaelites. But McLuhan saw that everybody was involved with this process and they could engage in the participatory, anticipatory, detached dialogue that they were being forced to experience anyways with the new memes that were thrown at people or evoked by people.
Right. An awful lot of this stuff can be found in I.A. Richards. And I think I.A. Richards was a continuing important influence on McLuhan. McLuhan was sort of talking about the same thing as Richards, he saw Richards as being too psychological, too materialistic. So
he would flip over to Leavis.
Yes, but I'm talking about in the 60s, let's say, he was pretty much over Leavis, but he wasn't over Richards. So the trajectory I see is in the 30s, he was decidedly Leavis versus Richards. And then over the next 30 or 40 years, he becomes less and less Leavis and more Richards.
When was that? What was the name of the essay, Leavis versus Richards, in the 44 or so? What was that?
Yeah, that's
one?
44, yeah.
That's poetic exegesis versus rhetorical exegesis, right?
Right, yes, sir.
So poetic exegesis was making a world, and rhetorical exegesis was what Leavis was doing or Richards was doing? Remember the difference?
Yeah, I'd have to go back to the essay to look, but if I, off the top of my head, I think he would probably associate Richards with rhetoric. He, in 1935, I think it was, maybe 34, 35, he attended a lecture series of Richards on rhetoric that then became a book. I forget what it's called, The Art of Rhetoric or something like this. McLuhan was very much taken by Richard's lectures and later by his book and later by Richard's notion in the 1950s of feed forward, which was basically the notion you were just talking about of...
Yeah.
Coming back on oneself.
Self-correction.
Yes, sir.
So what is the main theme he gets from Richards that he's still using in the 60s? Feed forward?
Well, I mean, the main theme from Richards is the complication of language and all that implies. And so McLuhan basically spent a lifetime gnawing on that question.
Yes, and but he saw it, you know, in that letter to Pound. You guys, Pound and Joyce, them, you understood the role of words and language in the creative process, but I have to deal with the fact that words have become a drug. See, so that's a later phase, a later problem that would make Richards weak in the long run. He'd use them for metaphors, but he had broken into a new territory of interdynamic of media environments.
I get a little nervous when you talk about new territory, advancing beyond and all that sort of stuff. But I think Leavis introduced McLuhan to the idea that the ambiguities of language have a certain grammar to them, and that this universal grammar can be applied to almost any problem. The difference with Richards is that McLuhan might be seen as saying, well, let's look at the very center of this dynamic and see what it implies. And for McLuhan, what it implied was a sense of language that wasn't only material, as it was for Richards, and that implicated religion and implicated a way out of the cul-de-sac. Whereas for Richards, because all language, including the understanding of language, was material and limited, then he never got out of the cul-de-sac. And in fact, he wrote a play, I think it was in 1954, right in the middle 50s anyway, and it was called A Hole in the Universe. Mm. And basically it had to do with the flatlining of everything.
Interesting. Now, Leavis seems to be influenced by Lewis, Leavis Lewis. What is Richards influenced by Eliot?
Oh, very much.
Yeah.
Eliot and Richards were very good friends, but Richards was a determined materialist. And so for, although he was a great teacher, and McLuhan owed a huge amount to him, at the end of the day, he just couldn't take Richards all that seriously. And the same thing with Eliot and Richards, right?
Yes.
So Richards, I think, was a seminal figure, but he was just so determined a materialist. And by the way, he was a mountaineer. So both he and his wife, and they climbed many of the highest mountains on Earth.
Mm.
So you can see this dialectic between reference to the sky and humiliation to the earth taking place in Richards.
Yeah, so Leavis and Lewis would move McLuhan out of the psychological of Richards in the 30s and 40s so he could appreciate Gideon and Innes. But when you get into the late 60s, where the individual is being elevated to or transformed into a discarnate super angel, that's what I meant. You start to confront your personal metaphysics, and that might put you back into the psychological again, because you're actually bigger and you're going around all the mixed corporate media environments, and digital life makes that even more extreme. That might have retrieved Richards for him, if you think of him as psychology. You see what I mean? That seeing the major media in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the macro environments, Leavis and Lewis would seem more relevant, and Eliot would fade off. But it would come back in the 70s as he saw the implosion of what Thiel called the co-anesthetic that put everybody in the director's chair. And then that anticipated the digital effect of everybody being the center of everything and broadcasting from their own discarnate position. I see that as retrieving, for at least for literate people or Westerners, the metaphysical and the psychological. And that would then account for the fad of Jung that happened in the 70s and 80s. He got retrieved, and yet Jung mixes the collective and individual in his psychology.
Yeah, definitely. I would have to think more about the sort of the timeline you're setting out and its markers. But it's certainly true that Jung was retrieved. He had been very, very important in the 20s and 30s. And then became important in slightly different ways, sort of in the 60s, 70s, time period. Jung is a very interesting form of Kluon, because of what you mentioned. It is this tension between the individual and the collective. When McLuhan writes Ong in 1944 and says that Jung may be more important for the church than Thomas, it's that individual collective tension that he has in mind, and the idea that if the church is going to survive in its present form, it's going to have to confront that tension.
And archetypes will be a part of that dialogue. Memes as archetypes.
Absolutely.
So what in the 90s and 2000s, who's retrieved? Nietzsche?
You mean in culture generally?
Yeah, in postmodernism, the postmodern era. Is Nietzsche retrieved like Jung was in the 60s and 70s?
Well, Nietzsche certainly was retrieved sort of a little bit. Postmodernism is very self-centered, right? It's a kind of juggling act where people are constantly saying, look at me, look at me.
Right, and that anticipates the digital world. That's what the trend was. You know, Tom Wolfe's friend of McLuhan, the me decade. There was a media environments, which were gigantic through most of the 20th century, were shrinking, and that's what I mean by holeopathic. So that the individual, the sense of a human being, which had senses plus extended senses, was dominating or swallowing all the media environments. And that's what I meant by the anthropomorphic physical coming back.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that next level is about. The holeopathic leash probes lead to people being bigger than media environments as they shrunk.
Right. And so, I mean, if you can, I think of Goya's painting of Saturn eating his children. I don't know if you remember that great, great picture of the massive Saturn bestriding the Earth and eating people as he goes. Think that they're eating and digesting the media environment, what they're really doing is destroying themselves, leading to the flat line.
Yep.
So that's what your vertical line is saying in the last three levels there.
Yes, and it's also the media are eating themselves as well as, you see, he says in Explorations in the 50s somewhere that the printing press made nature, and that includes humans, as its content. So the industrial progressive mandate came in of processing the earth. So the image of Goya's painting of a monster eating humans, that's the Gutenberg galaxy. When you get into the 20th century and the electric media, the media swallow other media. And McLuhan called it a civil war, and print sat on the sidelines. So the Android meme is eating each of its parts. And that's partly what I'm showing here. The Gorgon, the monster, to update Goya, is an image of, say, the movie Exorcism. And McLuhan said that was a great, popular, got a great response, because it expressed how people were possessed by media environments. So that began with the printing press and extremists, but then the media environments themselves were swallowed and redigested and spit out again, recycled in the, latter half of the 20th century. once you have the satellite environment. So
this is by each other, right?
Yes. Yeah.
The media eating, swallowing, spitting out, et cetera.
Yeah.
So what's interesting to me here is if this is taken in a synthetic, a synchronic sense, rather than a diachronic sense, that is to say in the all at once or big now sense. So this dynamic of the media themselves is something that's always going on.
Yes.
And the eating of each other is something that is already described by Plato. So Plato says that the dynamic of history is what he called the gigantomachia. And the machia in Greek is battle, B-A-T-T-L-E.
Yeah.
And so the gigantic battle that is the meaning of being, you could say, is always going on, says Plato. And the two of the great giants that are at war, namely the gods in the sky versus the titans of the earth, those two are trying to reduce each other to nothing. They're
Yes.
trying to take over everything. They're trying to eat the other, you could say. But the third member of this peculiar battle is the child. And what the child sees is that both are necessary even in order to have the battle.
Yeah.
Right? So the meaning of life is a threefold contest between two powers that are trying to eat each other and a third power that embraces those two. And the third power can never be alone by itself as if it were the truth, because it is the belonging together of those two gigantic antagonistic powers, right? And the two gigantic antagonistic powers can also never be alone, because the power that they're trying to eat is as powerful as it is, right? So you have this image already in Plato, and Aristotle understood it as Plato's greatest student. Already in Plato, you have this image of the dynamic of life between this threefold process. And my reading of McLuhan is that he is a kind of revitalization of this ancient image, right? In his writings in the 1940s, he keeps talking about the ancient quarrel. And the ancient quarrel is usually seen by him in terms of a threefold. So it can be the trivium, or it can be different types of art, different types of criticism. But at the end of the day, it's always a complex where you need to understand the integrity, as you always say, but the integrity is not something aside from the unintegrated powers.
Did you say somehow unintegrated?
Yeah. The integrated is somehow able to relate itself to that which is unintegrated.
Right.
That's the trick.
Yeah, and what you're saying is what I meant by Shimshon and Issy. Issy being the child and then the older brothers. So you have this
fight.
That's
the top of the chart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have the actors acting out this process, cultural enemy versus weaponry versus sociological, psychological lag. So
yeah, I can see that. That's
yeah.
You've got a lot built into these things, which people have to chew on these things. And if what they want to do is sort of look at them and get some sort of schema for understanding, they're not going to get it, because each one of these things is like an hors d'oeuvre. And if you eat 50 hors d'oeuvres, you're not going to get the taste of any one.
Exactly. So we come to this thing, what the heck does lockdown Bob Rule mean? So I made this notion in 95. Here it is 25 years later. Yeah, 25 years later. Incredible implosions and bifurcations have happened. We're into the flat line. I thought that because I was at the Center of Culture and Technology and had taken over the mantle of McLuhan, at least he made me feel that way once I thought I understood him. You know what I mean? He empowers one if you can master his process, his pattern recognition methodology. So now what happened is it came true. And this is a something that's recognized by well-known people, but not by the average citizen, and where I am today. Now, you find it interesting the way I'm presenting the book as a way of looking at Trump. Well, guess what? Trump is now in regular talks with me about what the heck my charts mean. Isn't that incredible?
Yes, it is incredible, in many senses of incredible.
Right, and it's all classified until today. What's today? Still the 20th. For me, the conversations with the president are generally classified. And I don't know what it means now. He's not president anymore. So anyways, that is a personal surprise that happened to me from 1990 to 2020. I thought I was in a position of, as we have with the first quote, superiority in relation to media. Superiority complex. You know, in the first quote, you have to have an arrogance to media. So I had that, and I would express it in many ways in media and radio interviews and everything all these years. But back then, I meant I'm not sure what I meant, because I had myself as president. I think I was thinking that everybody would be forced to be in that position. As more and more environments, technologies were absorbed, you'd be standing there as something, and you weren't sure how human you were, so it would become a discussion in yourself about what are you anthropomorphically, okay? How much do you project images of human from different past, different cultures? In this everything's disappeared situation, and I'm looking at memes. Memes become the enemy under Shem, and they're fighting against the monster of terrorism, dirty bombs and things, up against whatever meme became popular for a while in government or culture, in terrorism. So there's this.
I think, let me just interject here to see if I'm following. What I hear you saying is something like you were taking over McLuhan's way of interrogating things, and you began to think of this way of interrogation as being a kind of archetype.
Yes.
And so by calling this archetype Bob, you were not inflating yourself, your chemical body, to be the meaning of everything.
Right.
What you were doing is you were saying that everybody in a certain way is Bob if they understand the archetype of interrogation.
Yes. Yeah, McLuhan liked to quote that Rabelais saying, he demanded everybody to put down his plow, you know, this is in the 1500s or something, put down his plow and read his books. You remember that quote?
Yes.
Which is might be partly a Menippean thing, but the title, Center for Culture and Technology, what a megalomaniac statement. You know what I mean? I don't know if people realize that when they would go and look up the Center for Culture and Technology. They probably felt that he was putting on, or it was pretty central what he was doing, but they didn't probably get the humorous put-on part of it and actually the complimentary accuracy of it. And so you have that quote in that book by the British guy in the late 60s where McLuhan says, I'm the only one who knows what's going on. I think right. that, and he would add to that, that he had the guts to pretend he knew what was going on. And he saw all the discipline and all the experts, they didn't have that arrogance, they didn't have that put on, and they were weak, anemic. You remember that quote? He says, they don't even pretend to know what's happening. He pretended to know what was happening. And he came up with a pretty good pretense that sounded pretty real for a lot of people.
Right. So the pretend, the pretend there might be understood as a mask.
Yes.
And he could be seen as saying that people need to put on this same mask whereby they will understand how to interrogate each other, how to interrogate themselves, how to interrogate their fate, and this mutual interrogation enabled by this mask is our only way forward.
Exactly. And, you know, he had that phrase, exploring ignorance for discovery. But the other thing yep. is, in the review of William Burroughs, and Burroughs was a major challenger to McLuhan in the creative writing world or the put-on world of who knows what's going on. So in it, he talks about LSD gives you consumer dreams, but heroin allows you to put on the whole universe. So we've gone towards media that are heroin in the way they inflate people, where they put on many universes now, or many images of different realms, while maybe being an indifferent conductor of imagery. There's so much imagery that goes along, which was the LSD dream. You have, you know, super eating, digestion of images rapidly coming at you, or incredibly slowing down, depending. So I think it was pretty amazing insight. McLuhan figured out the meaning of each drug's effect and then saw, well, he didn't state it, but you could see how it applied to media. So consumerism of the Black Mirror today is people having a super LSD experience. They're contemplating the endless distraction of content that they can get on their smartphones. But they tend not to be a broadcaster, not in the sense of being Center for Culture and Technology. They'll broadcast on their Facebook page or within forums and small groups, echo chambers they call them. But the larger inflation of oneself, like heroin supposedly does, where you put on the whole universe, those people go into politics. So Trump is a major, quote, you know, heroin addict, super inflated, and puts on everything rather than being a good consumer. Though he would, they said, at night would watch all the TV talk shows all night long. So we have a mixture of yeah. both, actually, for the millennials and younger. But as the media, as we get into Web 1.0, that hyped up the co-anesthetic and the heroin experience more than the LSD experience. And that became the popular image of the hacker or the computer nerd. He's there eating junk food and stoned on something while making code.
Yeah.
That's someone who's become what they beheld.
Right, right. So the you're talking about the inflation and archetypalization of McLuhan, you could say, or not so much McLuhan, but of the type of interrogation that McLuhan was trying to define and trying to practice.
Yep.
And you could say that archetypalization was naturally at war with other types of archetypalization, and that would take us back to the gigantomachia that I was talking about from Plato.
Yes.
But what I'd like to do at this point, instead of going in that direction, I'd like to point out that the interesting thing about McLuhan is that he never lost his sense of his own absurdity.
Yeah.
Of himself having a smell and having, you know, worn out clothes and worn out cliches and all of this sort of stuff. So, for example, in the essay that I was quoting from before, McLuhan talks about, quote, the vast reservoir of failures past and future to come. It is this great Saragossa sea of forlorn endeavors to which we are now in the process of assigning ourselves.
Yeah.
So he has a tremendous sense of both his importance and his insight and of his stupidity and absurdity.
Yeah, and he expresses this in the 50s. He talks about Baudelaire, who had a hebdomadal or every 7 days seminar in his life, wherever it was in Paris. But McLuhan says he approached the existence of his time with great humility. You remember that phrase? I don't think it was humiliation.
But it sounds right.
Yeah, it's in one of his essays, the great humility of Baudelaire confronting his environment. And that's what you were just saying about McLuhan. Yeah.
Yeah. But not only confronting his environment, confronting himself.
Yes. And this is what everybody missed. Maybe they would project this because they were that way. They were biased. But people were intimidated by what appeared to be McLuhan's huge ego. But if you hung out with them, you'd see the humility in what you're describing and the sense of the absurd and the forlorn, lost condition of everybody. You had to mingle with them to see both parts, you know, so you wouldn't get thrown by what a lot of people thought he was a crazy megalomaniac like Wyndham Lewis or something.
Right, right.
And you can see
so
Finnegan's weight. Say that again?
I say you can see that in somebody like Carl Scharfer, that he wasn't, although he had a good understanding of McLuhan, I think, and had sort of the desire to follow McLuhan, he did so by going into social work, not by going into metaphysical thinking or into media ecology.
Who was this?
Carl Scharfer.
Oh, Carl Scharf. S-C-H-A-R-F-E, right?
Yeah, that's a German word, Scharfer.
Oh, well,
know how he pronounced it. Did he pronounce it Scarf?
Yeah, well, he was always, he was Carl Scharf. That's what everybody said.
All right, good.
Well, did you meet him?
No, but I've read all sorts of stuff in the Innes Herald.
Yes, yeah, yeah. No, Carl Scarf was, he was this almost homeless guy. You know, he would be around with the same clothes, didn't have much money, and he edited the anti-abortion Catholic newsletter or something that Eric's
right.
wife was on the staff
yeah,
also.
Yeah.
And he would, you know, he would, I often walked home from the Monday night seminars with him or walked in the same direction. And I was living with a woman who we could afford really good, organic, you know, healthy food. But Carl, we always stopped off and he'd go in to get his supper, which would be a McDonald's hamburger. And
man.
And I thought, you know, this guy's going to get unhealthy. But he didn't have
yeah.
the, didn't have the money. But he was very devoted to Mediacology, and he became very close to the McLuhan family.
Yes. Yeah.
And died
young from his habits, right?
That's right. And he and Wayne Constantino both died young.
Yeah.
And they were
yeah.
similar in their lifestyles. What was it, Carl? He used to... He would come up to me sometimes in the center, and he'd stand too close to you. He'd be like an Arab. Remember, they have to be like 8 inches
yeah.
or something
yeah.
from you, and he would get up real close to your face and interrogate you about something. So I would just keep my cool and let the guy be that close. But it was kind of funny what he did. I think he did it intentionally. He had read enough Edward Hall, or whatever his name is, the hidden language to do that. So he was an artist, a painter, cartoonist. So in that sense, he was aggressive like Wyndham Lewis. He had a Wyndham Lewis aspect to him. But it's interesting, you know of him just from the Innes Herald.
Yep.
Yeah, like he was the student at the college. He somehow got the job of editing it and steering it into a lot of McLuhan articles in the late 70s, and the school didn't seem to mind it. He hijacked the paper.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, some of his articles and interviews basically were the whole paper, the whole issue.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he had found a medium to put on Toronto with.
Correct.
Okay,
yeah.
So the so we talked about the drugs. And what is it about Carl? We were talking about Marshall combining megalomania or super arrogance with humility, which was our case. That's your individual versus the collective. The individual more
yeah,
and more.
Yeah, but they're not. The whole point is to focus on the tension.
Yeah.
Right? So the tension can vary from extremely explosive to different but integrated. And the whole McLuhan technique that you're talking about is how to go from the explosive and implosive tension to the integrated tension.
Right. Now, Derek de Kirchhoff, that the individual versus the collective comes in with literacy. So he would talk about the newly literate individual up against the collective. So he'd replay McLuhan, but he saw the printing press exaggerated that. But then I would say, you know, once you get to the telegraph, or at least movies and radios in the first half of the 20th century, that's a battle between collectivities, or what Marshall called the archetypes of the collective unconscious, or the media unconscious. But what surprised people was the digital flipped into retrieving the super angelic individual against media collectivity. So it retrieves the individual versus collective from the Gutenberg galaxy and back, but it's a whole new level of ethereal, virtual, engaging of environments you can't see anymore. You're in your phone, so they're meme or memetic. You're fighting memes, and I have that. The homeopathic cliche probes versus the satellite or air ground, the discarnate angelic, the satellite and laser beam. And we now have a major issue with narcissism. You've seen that's a new fad in diagnosis of public nuisances. Have you noticed that?
Well, I haven't noticed the discussion, but it's impossible to miss the fact.
Right. So that's partly, I think, what I meant by me. I'd be subject to the same stresses that everybody would be.
That's what I understand. You aren't the archetype, but the archetype can be called you.
Yes, and then out of it came the book, The Church of the Subgenius, 1983, the book of the subgenius, and they featured the archetype J.R. Bob Dobbs, they show him in cartoons and scenarios in the book, all through history. He's always there. He's back there with Moses. He's there with Napoleon. You know, name anybody, he's there. He's the archetype. The cartoon image was based on my father. And so you'll see the spinning image. So a curious synchronicity with leading avant-garde artists, which gathered around the church subgenius, I call that Xenochrony. And that's what's going to be, that's a title on the chart, so I'm leading into the chart here, the tiny note chart. Xenochrony was Frank Zappa's term for he recorded all his concerts and everything. So he'd take a guitar solo from one song, one concert, and then take some drum stuff or a bass or horns from another song at a different time, totally not to be relatable. That would be the supposition. And then he put them together, and he would want them to stay separate and dissonant, but they often merged or synced up. So that was strange synchronization. So that's Zeno. So he came up with the word Xenochrony, and so then I applied it to my own media life, where many times people would say, well, you've talked about this and that's in that movie, Bob. That movie's about you. Now, I don't go around looking for movies about me, but I'm told by others, so they see it. So I had a public synchronization or synchronicity going on, which I used as called Xenochrony. Whereas many people often today, and they report to you and me and everybody, they have synchronicities all the time, more and more because of the nature of, I think, our media situation. But I said, no, you've got a lot of synchronicity, but you don't have Xenochrony, strange synchronization, which I have because I've talked about it in public for years. People know the concept from me, adapted from Zappa, and they will point out where they see examples of my synchronicity that I didn't even know about. You see what I'm saying? And that is a key part of the tiny note chart, which we can start, depending on how much time you have, we can start going into. But that's a key factor in the me phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. That's a question I wanted to ask you. You said you used the word me many times in your discussion there, where you were talking about movies about me or movies with me, and people seeing me in different things. So before we talked about Bob as the archetype of investigation or interrogation.
Yes.
And we talked about the importance of humility and of knowing oneself absurdity. So when you use the word me, how does that relate to the discussion of the archetypal you and the absurd you?
That's in the word me-dia. Media. That's me,
okay,
dia.
And how do you understand me, dia?
That, as McLuhan would say, you know, on the frontier in the old westerns, you had to forge a new identity every day. because there was, I don't know, less continuity of a town or
right,
a city.
Right.
You know, there wasn't a stable
so
environment.
That's like Bob as the archetype of interrogation.
Yes. And so you have to forge a new identity, or you're forced to by everybody else forging new identities every day.
Mm-hmm.
So you die every day. And Bob Dylan, sure, his mid-60s songs, he tapped into this as a young poet. He described it a lot in his middle-60s songs. Do you know that he said in 1985, if you want to understand the 60s, you read Norma Mailer and Marsha McLuhan? And that's pretty perceptive. By a guy who, you know, was ravaged by a fame that threw him for a loop. You know what I mean? He somehow later figured out that McLuhan was a good guide to surviving what he went through in his fame level, and certainly would like to have a discussion with him about it sometime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know. There's Peter Gabriel. There's different couple of artists who mention McLuhan in their lyrics, but they don't say McLuhan is a guide to the incipient tumultuousness of the 60s. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty perceptive,
sure,
statement from a pop star or a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
Another character is Jack Nicholson. He, in an interview in the early 70s, said when he read McLuhan about cliche, maybe he read from cliche archetype, but he said that really crystallized whatever he thought he was doing as an actor. He figured out how to act through McLuhan's notion of cliché. And then Mary McLuhan knew Jack Nicholson and Warren Beatty in the mid-80s at a place. That guy I told you, David Greenberg, who was the last McLuhanite
going to bring
McLuhan to L.A., well, he ran an artist's hangout place in Los Angeles, and so Mary was a friend of David and would go there, and that's how she met Nicholson and Beatty. But they would go to the beach often and read Understanding Media to each other. Understanding Me Daya. So I always thought that was in there, you know, media, Me Daya. And Ted Carpenter marries the DIA Foundation, you know, the major art institution in New York, DIA, that was created by his wife's family.
Mm-hmm. And how are you, but I still don't understand how you're understanding DIA. How are you understanding Me Daya?
Well, me dying, okay, it means dying.
Dying, okay, so you're using it as not the meaning of the word, but as a suggestion, as
a pun.
Okay, I understand. So then, what I would say to that is that I think you said you would have to die every day to your identity. What I understand McLuhan to be talking about in All at Onceness is that on the spectrum of human possibilities, in order for there to be different possibilities, there have to be gaps, there have to be borders that differentiate the different possibilities from each other.
Yes.
So in all at onceness, there is a kind of death, there is something that is that cannot be experienced, and where there is no identity, right? It's the nobody on the frontier, as McLuhan would say.
Everybody into nobody.
Yeah, that in the all at once spectrum, where every human being is a kind of player of this piano, there is death and non-identity, both between human beings and that piano, and in between each of the keys of that piano. So the me daya, in your sense, describes this sort of total picture of life's possibilities on the one hand, which are universal and in a sense infinite, as contrasted to the finite individual. And what brings cohesion to all of this is what McLuhan calls tactility. It is the non-identity and death that is between each of the possibilities and between the range of possibilities and the finite individual.
And then I would say the opposite to what you're saying and include that in a tactile interplay.
The opposite being time?
I don't know what it is. Uh-huh. Whatever you left out.
One interesting thing of Midaya is that Daya, for example, in dialogue.
Yes.
Right. Daya means through. Right.
Yeah.
So Midaya can be understood as the necessity of me going through a process where the me becomes essentially changed, or changed through obliteration.
Through the vanishing point. But that would be one mirror. We have to include now all the different sensory vanishing points, or whatever a throughness would be in each sensory mode and its extension. And when I say throughness, throughput, I think LaRouche uses that word a lot, throughput. Do you know that word anywhere?
Oh yeah, throughput is often used in describing manufacturing.
Yeah, that's what he was writing about. Okay, so we've got a lot of manufactured tunnels we go through now.
Uh-huh. Well, if we think about the spectrum that I was just calling a piano, but if we think of the spectrum of possibilities, the dia, the through that separates all the different possibilities, those aren't necessarily the same. So when you talk about the need to go through all these different mirrors, that is part of the image that I'm describing.
Yes.
It would be anybody who says, I know what all of those blanks is about, is obviously nuts.
Yeah, what is it? Didn't McLuhan say that the insane person makes connections and then makes them rigid, gets rigid
yes.
in the process
yes.
of making connections?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how are we doing for the time?
Well, I could do a little longer, but how are you doing?
I'm okay. We can go. I'd like to go into the beginning of the tiny note chart.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah, let's get the transition there. There may be any time you want to go back and talk about this chart, you're welcome. We can hop back
yeah,
and
yeah.
forth, get into the big now of what we're talking about.
Right.
So
let me just point out that Xenos in Greek means the stranger. So
yeah, Zeno.
Z-E-N?
Z-E-N-O. Yeah, stranger. That's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, that's right. So it's times that are somehow times plural that are somehow times singular, and that time plural can be conceived as the meeting of strangers.
Yes. Times juxtaposed, the meeting of strangers. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the tiny note chart is times and spaces.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I click on the chart. Can you bring up the chart for yourself? Do you know where it is?
Yeah, I have it in PDF form.
Okay, so this is that. Okay, I have it. All right, so first of all, it's a piece of paper. It's visual, and it's print. So it's a specialized view of what I'm going to call the Android meme, which is the internet world, of the early 90s and then on. So I'm aware of the bias of the presentation of the picture of the Android meme. So that's at the top. At the very top, I say a chain letter of phase shifts. So there's the reference to the letter, to the visual artifact, visual space, and it's connected, more visual space stuff, and it refers to the letter that's searched for in Finnegan's Wake. So Finnegan's Wake also, it shows the co-anesthetic and the synchronistic in extremis in that book about LSD, you know, LSD versus heroin. Joyce has got those two modalities or effects in that book. So I wanted to say that, you know, half an hour ago.
And I wanted to add half an hour ago that when McLuhan reads Burroughs, he takes Burroughs himself to satirize in a certain way the drugs. So yes. McLuhan doesn't read Burroughs as saying, if you go to heroin, you get the answer. He reads Burroughs as presenting a conflict of worlds where no one world is the answer.
Exactly. And note that he mentions Lewis, parallels Joyce and Lewis, and he says they're rigid media ecologists. They panic. He has the shut off button, I think is the phrase. You know, they're trying to make the button go on or off. When he encountered media ecologists close to his perceptual style, he distanced himself from them. It allowed him to take another detached, maybe what you would say, move into tactility in relation to a innocent media ecologist. So he makes fun of Joyce panicking in this situation. But if you don't have Joyce in the neighborhood, McLuhan looks like he's panicking in the way he presents Joyce is. You get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So there's
sure, anybody can be taken as panicking if they're taken to represent a certain position.
Yeah. And so Don Thiel used to mention that that Finnegan's Wake satirized apocalyptic visions, or those that thought they were coming to an ending point, you know, and you would mm-hmm. like an end times reference point or cliche.
Right.
So that's pretty sophisticated. That Joyce is including all stages of apprehension. So it has to include a satire of what you think the book is warning people about. He has to satirize himself in a way.
Sure. Sure, the letter is in a dung heap.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so looking at the chart, the Dobbs formula chart, we took I have to bring it back up, so I'm going back to the formula chart, and you have the telegraph level at the top, then movies, that's on the left ground. Telegraph, movies, radio, television, that's four. Then computer and atom bomb, satellite and laser beam make six. And then you've got 7, 8, 9, holopathic cliche probes, anthropomorphic physical, and flatline. So the 7 and 8 become the tiny note chart. The flat line is at the bottom of the chart. So let me go back to the chart, to the tiny note chart. And you look at the very bottom. It says, waiting for organic bodies, the spinning clothing crystals have danced the hexadvertisement. So that's the sixth level. That's off the chart. It's the observer looking at the Android meme. And it's from a completely new situation. So the flat line is indicated by that statement. the flat line is you're sort of off the chart. Does that mean anything to you?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it means to me what it should mean, but the way I hear it is the kind of superiority that you indicate at the start of your book, and that McLuhan said was necessary for media analysis.
Right, and there's also the humility. So the humility comes from the second quote at the start of the book, where every politician or lawyer has a conflict of interest. They're in the web.
Right. And for Joyce, and I think McLuhan really appreciated this in Joyce, it's the humble part of everybody isn't necessarily that their thought isn't perfect or something like this. It's that they are physical bodies subject to breakdown that are a image and a cause, you might say, of intellectual breakdown. Right? The intellectual breakdown isn't kind of in charge of things. Instead, the incarnation is in charge of things, and the incarnation is inherently humble.
Yes. Now, did you say muffle in your opening statement?
Humble. Humble as in humiliation.
Oh, humble. Okay, yeah, I didn't get that. Right. Okay, I agree with that. So then, you have a chain letter of phase shifts. So that's the linearity as you go through the sequence.
Could I talk about that just for a second?
Yeah.
You say a chain letter of phase shift. So a chain letter is normally something that unfolds in time.
Yes.
In linear time, right? But it's possible to think of a chain letter as something that's instantaneous, as something that is all at once, where you have the different links of the chain forming some kind of spectrum, you could say.
Yes.
So then, having said that, what I want to do is I just want to take a look at the etymology of phase, because phase normally is taken to be something in time, one after another.
Yes.
Right? Phase is almost like stage. But if I can find, I had this a second ago, but I have so many windows open that I can't find. Oh, here we are. Here we are. Phase goes back to phases of the moon. Particular
yes.
recurrent appearance. Right. So here, phase as a noun, even with the Greeks, was already associated with the moon and with the recurrent phases of the moon. And so phase, in the etymological sense, gets away from phase as a linear stage and comes to be a circular movement like the phases of the moon, right? And
yes.
That was that notion of phase, which is related to phanine in Greek, which means to show, and we have that word in phenomena and phenomenology, things like that. The Greek notion of something showing itself is related to how the moon shows itself. It never shows itself all at once. It shows itself in phases, but those phases are circular, right?
Yes.
And then we have the use of the word phase, meaning phase can be thought as relating to speaking. I'm trying to think of what the etymology is there, but the phasing is there was a Greek word for talk, which is phas, and that word we have in English in words like fantasy, for example, right?
Yes.
And so once when we realize that phase is related to fantasy and to words that have to do with a kind of speaking or a kind of expressing that comes out of us, we can see how phase was related to the moon, and that the moon was expressing itself, was talking to us in terms of its phases. So I just want to bring out how the use of the word phase in your tiny note chart is actually a very complicated question of what a phase shift could amount to.
Yes.
It's got a very deep history and a very complicated history.
Right. So a couple of points. So the chain letter is linear and connected. And then what's below the title? Cyclotron. There's your circle. Cyclotron of homeopathic cliche probes. So you know what a cyclotron is. I think McLuhan yeah. uses that word once or twice.
Yeah, I think he does.
Yeah. So you have... in his introduction to Counterblast 1969, he says Wyndham Lewis put himself into a cyclotron of his time and obliterated himself. Remember that sentence? In the preface to Counterblast. He talks about self-condemned is about that, what he did to himself. So he put himself into a cyclotron of memes and media. And then I have underneath causes merging with effects. And causes is got quotes around it, and that's referring to page 137 of Take Today, the bottom of the page. Did we discuss that quote? I think we did.
Yeah. The very are you talking about the
very bottom?
The bottom.
Yeah.
No, but of the tiny note chart or of the page?
Oh no, of page 137 in Take Today.
Yeah. Okay, that's what I thought you were saying. Yeah. So we have discussed that. That's where you see the typography is very important
yes.
to McLuhan's meaning.
Right. So what else was it? Do you know what a chain letter is, Lisa?
Yeah.
You know, you send it out to somebody, and then they're supposed to make 10 copies or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that's then, I'm referring to that. Popular meaning. Maybe it's the only meaning, a chain letter, phase shifts. So
One of the implications of a chain letter is that you send it out to 10 people and they're supposed to send it out to 10 people each.
Yeah.
But each person that gets the letter is supposed to send a dollar or something back to the original person.
Yes.
And so if the chain letter works, you wake up one day and you're a millionaire.
That's right. Okay, so is that a Ponzi scheme?
Yes. Well, okay. I mean, it all depends. If it misrepresents itself, it's a Ponzi scheme. If it just says, you know, this is a way of me getting money from everybody, then it's not.
It's not, did you say?
No. If it doesn't misrepresent itself, it's not a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, okay. So the title is Xenarchronous Bob's Tiny Note equals the Grand Wazoo's Decade Dance or Decadence. So the Grand Wazoo was an orchestra that Zappa formed in 72 into 73, and he toured with it in the fall of 72. And it was a different direction from the music that he seemed to be specializing in the late 60s, early 70s. It brought in a jazz fusion aspect in a very original way. So the decade is developed by Barry Nevitt in his book ABC of Prophecy. So you have this dance within the cyclotron, and it's creating all kinds of synchronicities or matchings that people more and more are getting inflated by. And Zappa talked about the universe being, at the ground of it being a big note. So this is my answer to that. This is a tiny note. And so I'm going to show the synchrony that's possible in the Android meme, which is Web 1.0, and then predicts Web 2.0 accidentally, or it was implied in the big now of the chart. I don't know. So waiting for organic bodies at the bottom, the spinning clothing crystals, so the spinning aspect of the cyclotron, and media is closed, and they get more and more crystallized. I don't know what that means. Baudrillard talks about the crystal. They get crystallized, consolidated, counter the melting of the implosion. And they dance the hexad, which is two steps past the tetrad. And all this process is trying to get a an integral something, which I'm calling organic bodies, but it has to consider the other bodies, the chip body, TV body, and the astral body, not just the chemical body. And that can mean more bodies, and with ION, we found out about the mystery body. So I kind of predict what's going to happen to me in the next 15 years, from 95 to 2009, 14 years. But I didn't know that then.
So this is what you're talking about is below the tiny note chart, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's off the chart.
Yes, it's the hexadic line. It's in the hexadic position.
Gotcha.
And it was inspired by Carolyn's work in New York from 93 to 97, 98. Some people in New York were working with a new technology, and a patient of Carolyn's was in New York, knew these people, came to her and asked her if she'd be interested in this, and she said, sure. So the wife of the inventor came to Toronto in August 1990 and showed her what this technology could do. It could treat AIDS. It had already done one study, and it was pretty successful. So she said, that's interesting. I'd like to go to New York and work on that. So we go to New York in 93. She's back and forth in 92. She finished her practice the last week of December 1991. So it took her a year to withdraw from the Toronto medical practice, but she was using the technology right away for a year in Toronto. Then in 92, as the inventor got funding to do the second study, we waited for that through 92, and then we got to go to New York in February 93. So by 95, I could see the results of this technology. It was pretty amazing. So what it was, Walter Fishman, he was the inventor, he would take herbs and potentize them, which means make them homeopathic. Okay? So you had two dynamics there, herbs and homeopathy. So the solution that came out of that process would be put into a syringe needle, which would then be laid in a little box, a little nice little holder. Oop. What's that? Are you still there? Did you get cut off?